Are you registered to vote? Headcount is a nonpartisan organization that works with the music and entertainment industry to get fans to vote. To update or check your voter registration status, go to headcount.org, where you'll find all the information you need to be ready for Election Day.
Headcount tours with musicians to help concert attendees register to vote, but you don't need to leave your house to register or to get voting info. Register to vote by visiting headcount.org. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Mixtape Memories. I'm Matt Hartspade.
And I'm Jenners.
We have another special guest this time around, Mona Dagan, Senior Director of Marketing at Mute Records, and she's also the founder of Mona Me Records. How are you doing, Mona?
I'm good. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yes, it's going to be a good episode. I haven't seen you in person in ages and ages, so this is a nice way to kind of catch up in these crazy times.
Seriously, such a treat to see both of your faces, so thank you.
I know. I feel like I only see people on the gram now. It's like the gram or Zoom.
It's dark.
Yeah.
Totally. I know. Well, we met through like a mutual friend a long time ago because we both had a love of RuPaul's Drag Race. So.
Yes. A love that still thrives.
Yeah. And I saw that a bunch of like drag queens were in the Erasure video, the new Erasure video.
Yes, the Nerves of Steel video.
Did you have a hand in that?
I wish, but I want to say that I did kind of subconsciously, because I talk about drag and Drag Race every week to the head of marketing in the UK, who's the one that commissioned the video. So I feel like I was just feeding him the inspiration subtly, but I didn't do anything.
Well, it came out great regardless.
Yeah,
the director and producer Brad Hammer did an excellent job, and like I thought all the queens did such a good job. It's such an awesome array of talent in there, so I was excited about it too.
Yeah, and I mean we'll get further into Erasure later in the episode, but I mean it must be kind of a trip to like kind of just work with them for the last X amount of years. No?
It is pretty insane. Like, I genuinely feel like a child sometimes, because I've been a fan since, it sounds like I'm exaggerating, but no joke, since I was 8 years old, because my sister was 10 years older than me and she kind of raised me. So she, like, most of my childhood was spent in her car in the passenger seat just listening to her CDs and tapes and stuff. And Erasure and Depeche and Yaz and, like, a bunch of those Mute bands were all on repeat in her car. And I just grew up, like, daydreaming to all those songs. So the fact that I get to work with them now is, like, an honors and understatement.
Yeah, I bet. Speaking of your sister and childhood and whatnot, I was wondering if we could take it all the way back to those early tapes and rides in the car and kind of what you were drawn to before you fully were involved in the industry.
I remember my first actual mixtape was, it's funny because it was Louder Than Bombs, which is already like a compilation of Smith songs, but I like remember distinctly like my pink handwriting on my tape, and I put it in my own order, but I didn't know the names of the songs, so all the names were like la-di-la-dow or whatever. So I think that was my first mixtape, and then as I got a little bit older, like I would listen to the radio a lot when I was younger, like alternative radio, and just record. So like the mixtapes were not very good because you'd miss like the first couple seconds of the song, or like there'd be a voiceover or something at the end. But like that was another early version of mixtaping for me.
Oh, totally. I would love doing that.
It's the best.
You're just like waiting like for them to start. But I feel like I did that with like Madonna and Bobby Brown.
So good. I remember also doing that with like videotapes, like I guess video mixtapes, like on 120 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you just wait for your favorite song to come on.
Yeah. I remember, like, videotaping, like, Pearl Jam Unplugged. And then I was, like, in art class in high school, and I would, like, try to draw Eddie Vedder, like, from a still. Like, pause.
I would videotape the VMAs and then try and use it for my mixtapes as if I were, like, kind of hosting a radio show.
Oh,
so, like,
awesome.
If Jamiroquai, I know he won, like, all the awards one year for Virtual Insanity, I would take that audio and then pretend I was having an interview with Jamiroquai, and then play, like, a radio cutoff version with the DJ's voice over it of the same song.
Aww.
It was really, really poorly constructed, but
so
it was fun
cute.
At the time. Yeah,
that's really cute. I love that.
That's so cute.
But it's funny you mentioned Louder Than Bombs, because later in the episode we will get into Morrissey as well. But that was my first introduction to the Smiths when I was 18, was Louder Than Bombs. A friend had made me a mixtape and put on Half a Person and Maybe Sheila Take a Bow. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that was also kind of my intro.
I have a half a person story for you at some point, whenever is the time.
Well, let's do a half a person story.
Do
Why
it,
not?
Go.
It's a throwback. It's from, like, what, 1985? So, yeah.
I picture it. Like, I'm like, Los Angeles, 2000. And Morrissey was doing, I think, like, a series of shows. I want to say at the Wiltern, but I can't remember where it was. But that was when I was following him on tour. And I was like, I'm 18. Nobody can tell me what to do. I'm going to every single show. Mm-hmm. So I would just drive from city to city, park outside the venue, and then just sit in line all day and then wait to go in. Mm-hmm. And in L.A., the crowds were really rough. Like, it was like the L.A. gang member, like Morrissey gang member. So it was like the Boy Racers versus mm-hmm. the so-and-so. I don't even know. But I hadn't eaten all day. It was very hot outside. So by the time I get in, I'm feeling not my best, I guess. And the crowds are really intense. Like, they're pushing, they're screaming, like, it's sweaty, so much energy. And I want to say, like, four or five songs in, I start to feel like I'm losing it. Like, I'm like, I can't handle this anymore. Mm. I was, like, in the second row. I don't think I was even standing anymore. Like, you're just being levitated.
You're floating,
by the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So security sees, like, she's going down. So they come to get me. They're pulling me out of the crowd. The crowd sees what's happening and is using my legs as leverage to get to Morrissey.
Oh,
so, like, the security guards are pulling my arms. The crowd is pulling my legs.
That's scary as hell.
I know. And Morrissey comes over and he's doing Half a Person and he comes to get me and, like, puts his hand out to me and is singing Half a Person into my eyeballs as I'm, like, spinning upside down and, like, all around while the crowd is trying to, like, get me to get to him. He finally, like, gets me loose. Security, like, rushes me off and throws me to the back of the venue. And I, like, what just happened? And Morrissey finishes the song, and he's like, see, I can save everyone except myself.
That is a good one.
Oh, my God, that's such a good story.
And that's my story for you.
Wow. Wow, that's a good one.
You can
I
stay.
Love that you were following him around in the country.
I was so into him, like, so into him. He represented everything mm-hmm. to me as, like, someone growing up in a small town where, like, there was no counterculture. There was, like, no, like, I didn't really see gay people. I didn't really see, like, culture in the sense of, like, literary stuff or, like, I don't know, just all these things that he introduced to my life that were really important to me. And, like, my first tattoos were Girl Afraid. Like, the Smiths mm-hmm. were everything to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, when I was, like, 18, I was like, I'm going.
And which tour was that? Like, around what album?
It was the Maz Angelus album. Do you remember where he was doing, like, he was dressing like Elvis, like the 68 comeback Elvis.
Yes.
But I can't remember what album it was for. I think it was after You Are the Quarry.
Oh, you're right. There was a string of albums after You Are the Quarry.
Yeah.
I feel like it was maybe like a best of around You Are the Quarry,
mm-hmm,
I want to
mm-hmm.
say.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I always wished I would follow him around, but I just kind of always saw the local shows. And then sometimes I'd go to Philly or go upstate, you know.
Well, I saw your show number, and I was like, that's pretty good.
But well, you know what's funny? So I've seen 24. We'll talk about Morrissey for a second, and then we'll escape and come back. But yeah, so I've seen 24 Morrissey shows, but I feel like whenever I'm at a Morrissey show, the people in front of me are telling me that their tally is like 114, and I feel like, what am I even doing here, you know?
I literally stopped keeping count because of that, because I was like, I give up. I'm never going to meet all these meet their levels. So I'm at like 40-something, but uh-huh. Like, same thing. Like, you go to these shows, and they're like, 97,000 times.
It's like, damn. Then you're really devoting your life, you know, to someone. And Jin and I have talked multiple times on the podcast about stan culture and, like, I don't know. I feel like maybe it's easier when you're younger, but the older you get, it's just kind of a pain in the ass. Like, now at this age, I can't imagine, like, following any act around every city. I mean, you'd have to, like, your whole life would be different. You know, I guess you'd have to be independently wealthy and all sorts of things.
How did you, like, transition from, like, you know, being a fan, going to the concerts, to, like, more, like, working in the music industry?
From volunteering at my college radio station, actually. I started there when I was 18 or so. And then I feel like when you're that age, you just start starting to find your tribe. And that felt very much like my tribe. It was like a bunch of nerds, a bunch of people into music. They were the kind of weirdos at school. So I felt like that was where I wanted to spend all my extra time. And so through college radio, I ended up moving to England to get my master's in radio because I loved it so much. I was like, this is what I want to do with my life. I mean, master's in radio, I don't know how useful that was for it, but in a weird way it was, because it ended up leading me to working at Six Music over there and working at BBC London. And then that led me to getting a job back managing the college radio station I volunteered at. So then after that, I ended up getting offered the job at Sub Pop to head their radio promotions department. So nice. Radio, in a weird way, ended up becoming my stepping stone into the industry.
Were you ever like a DJ on the radio station?
Yes.
Okay.
I was Mona.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's how I learned how to DJ, actually, was through Calyx.
Yeah, I love that you also, on top of like everything else you do, throw DJ parties with like cool music themes, not like your usual dance party. So you're keeping that like tradition alive of like cool dance parties, because I don't think you see that anymore. Like, it was all over the place in the aughts, I feel like. But
yeah, there are fewer now, I feel, especially to cater to things that we would actually want to dance to.
Totally. You know? It's actually hard because there's not as much of a crowd for it as you would think there would be, or maybe I'm just a poor promoter, but like, it's hard because I think a lot of the people that are into that are our age. There's a lot more like other things you'd want to be doing, probably like Netflixing or whatever, you know, going to a show or something. So, I mean, the competition is stiff, but at the same time, like, I liked it. I don't need like 300 people in a room to feel good about it. Like, I'm stoked if there's 20 kids there. Kids.
Yes. No, I feel you, because like I was just telling Matt like before we started this, like I was like, I always want to go to Mona's parties, but then I'm just like so lame.
Well, we get old and lazy, you know.
I'm the same. But also I feel like, I don't know, I wonder how it's going to be after all this. Like, do you think people are going to feel the same? Are we going to, like, want to go out more? Am I never going out again?
In my opinion, I think, listen, we're kind of in this boat, and we'll be in this boat for quite some time. But I do feel like once things are 100% safe, like, let's say it's summer or fall of next year, I think there is going to be such a hunger for people to go out and experience something in a live way. And never be on Zoom ever again, you know, unless you kind of have to be. So I do think it'll come back. It's just, it'll be a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to need like a vaccine, you know, like some kind of guarantee that you can get better and you probably won't die. Like, if you get it. I mean, 99.9.
Little things to ask when you're going out.
Exactly.
So, like, how was it working at Sub Pop and then kind of, you know, moving on from there?
Because then you went to Domino, no?
Yes. Okay. So Sub Pop was my first label job. And that was amazing in the sense of, like, getting to work with these legends like Jonathan Poneman and Megan Jasper and, like, just the history of Sub Pop. And I was there at the 20th anniversary. So that was an amazing year to be there because we did that big festival. Mm-hmm. And there was, like, a party at the top of the Space Needle and they flew the Sub Pop flag. And so I just felt really honored to be a part of that experience. But I think the time was not a good time for me to be living or moving to Seattle as a single person. Like, yeah. I didn't know anybody. I didn't really have any friends. The people that worked at the label were all older or established, so they were not interested in going out all the time. And, like, I just felt super lonely in Seattle. So I left after a year and moved to New York and worked at Domino. So that's mm-hmm. where that happened. Mm-hmm. Which was amazing, which is like the counter opposite of the experience I had in Seattle, where, like, I felt like the city really, New York is one of those places that can open its arms to you that I think that some cities don't. Like, I think Seattle and London were a little harder to assimilate into or feel comfortable. I don't know if I ever felt super comfortable in either, but New York, I felt like really opened its arms to me. Like, I met friends right away. I found places I wanted to go. It just felt really welcoming, so that's why I'm still here.
What year around was that when you
2008?
Oh, nice. Okay. yeah I remember that year. Yeah. it still was cool. Like, it was fun to go out that year, like, you know, even though it was like the ending of the aughts, I guess, but, like, you know, things were still happening. I was less in Williamsburg, I think, at that time, and more in, like, starting to South Slope or South Brooklyn, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which, like, I never thought would happen. That's weird. But, yeah, I always, like, thought, like, working for somebody like Sub Pop would be, like, one of those dream boxes that you just, like, tick off, you know?
It definitely was in a lot of ways. But I think that that's also the weird thing of if it's all time and place. Like, I feel like if I had moved there now, I probably would still be there, but I was 23 at the time, and I was like, let's rage. Nobody wanted to.
I worked at, like, a booking agency that they, like, ended up partnering with at one point. That was my little thrill. I was like, I kind of work for them.
That's like, awesome. What was the agency?
Inland Empire.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And then through that, I met Jonathan Poneman and, like, Megan Jasper, and I was just like, I can't believe this.
They're the, like, coolest people in the world.
Yeah. Yeah. And exactly like how everyone says they are. Just, like, cool and chill and just, like, pleasant to be around.
Yeah.
At what point did you kind of decide to start your own label, seek out acts and put stuff out digitally and physically?
That was not too long after I moved to New York. Mm-hmm. There was a band I was friends with from San Francisco called Magic Bullets. Mm-hmm. And I think it was 2009. And I was, like, trying to help them find a label deal because I really believed in them. They sounded like the Smiths, kind of, or like the 80s Altered Images kind of vibe. And nobody would sign them. So I was like, why don't I start a record label and just put it out? And that would be a fun way for me to, like, have creative control over everything. And I was the communications manager at Domino then, so I was doing radio and press. Mm-hmm. So I was doing radio and press for my own label too, and, like, it was awesome. We got, like, Pitchfork reviews and WFUV sessions and, like, all these cool things that I felt really proud of because I was like, mm-hmm. it was all me, like, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. yeah, that was a really exciting thing. And I think it's still like that for me, like, it's an outlet where I can take mm-hmm. complete ownership creatively and also, like, feel that, like, it was 100% me.
And it's still a one-woman operation, right? Like,
yeah, it has not grown in the last 10 years.
But you did just release, like, this amazing compilation that benefits Alzheimer's Association called The Longest Day. And that was kind of, like, your modern mixtape. I know that, like, your father has been going through the disease. Like, was this kind of like a healing way to heal for you?
Yeah. I mean, the ironic thing is that, well, I don't know if it's ironic, but the interesting thing is that my dad actually was the one that loaned me the money to start my record label. And through the label is like how I got to save money that ended up being able to help him when we were like in financial crisis. Because when we discovered he had dementia a year ago, all his bank accounts had been wiped, like there were liens on his properties and whatever. So like that was amazing that I was able to use the tool that he had given me to like help him back in the end. But so yeah, that's what this compilation is about. It comes out physically October 1st. It's out digitally right now, but it's for the Longest Day, which is the Alzheimer's Association's yearly fundraiser. Fundraising incentive. And I just last year I'd done like a long DJ set and raised $3,000, and I was like, why don't I put out a compilation this year and see if I can like get some more money? And which is great, because so far we've already raised $6,500 for the Alzheimer's Association. And it was absolutely a healing process. It's funny because it's not even about the money. Like for me, in the end, it ended up being this tool over the last year that I could think of that wasn't negative, that was really related to Alzheimer's. It was something positive that I could actually make a change or do something. And one of the things that I did for the pre-order is that if you pre-ordered the physical, you could have a name of a loved one put into the artwork. And weirdly, seeing all the names come in ended up being a very therapeutic thing for me too. And just, you know, I never thought of that, you know, when they're like, say their name, or the how really, really impactful it is to have an actual person attached to these big concepts, or like, and how less alone I felt through it. And I hope that's how people feel when they get the product.
We were wondering also specifically about your memories of the aughts, I guess, while you were at Domino and when you moved to New York, just kind of going out and what kind of things you saw, and what were some of your like key memories as it relates to live music and DJ sets and stumbling around the city and whatnot?
I will be honest. I remember more of the aughts in San Francisco because I think my brain was younger and I was like in college, and I remember going to Pop Scene and like seeing all the bands that were around there, like the Walkman playing tiny venues, or like, do you remember Elephant with an F?
Of course. They were a big block band.
Yeah. I remember that guy being like, I would make you pregnant with this next song. Like, totally. I will like never forget that stage banter. But yeah, I feel like the Hot Hot Heat and like, I don't know, Electro Clash and all those fun things, I have very vivid memories of the Bay Area. And I feel like in New York, I'm ashamed to say it, my memory is like gone. And I think it's maybe because the drinking time was extended till 4. So like,
yes.
I don't know what
happened. We've talked about this on the podcast. I think unfortunately a lot of memories have gone away.
There's like, have you seen that NME thing where it's like, they quiz artists on like their past to see how much they remember, to see how much is gone from like drugs and rock and roll, whatever. I would have zero memory. I would have like a 0 out of 0 on that one.
I haven't seen that, but I'm going to Google it.
Yeah, I'm going to look also.
Like, people have been like, remember that time? I was like, no, I wasn't there. And they'll be like, here's a picture of you standing next to me at this thing. And I'm like, I don't think I was there.
But you know what, it was, you know, Jen and I talk about this a bunch. It was just part of the culture. It was like hand in hand. You'd check out the band, you'd have a drink, you'd talk to the publicist, the manager, the band maybe, and then on to the second act. And next thing you know, it's 1 in the morning and you've had 5 drinks and you're having a good old time, but you don't remember the details. They get fuzzy.
Totally.
Especially if, like, there's free drinks.
Yeah.
Yes, there was a lot of free drinks back then. And I remember what you were saying about like going from place to place. Mm-hmm. That's what I loved about New York, is it wasn't like California where like you go to one place and maybe a second, like for an after party. I feel like New York, you were like, boom, boom, boom. Like, I'm going to see 7 exactly. shows. I'm going to this thing. My friend's DJing the after party. Like, so yeah, it's no wonder. Like, how are we to remember exactly. all these details?
I feel like for me, it was even worse when I'd go to Austin, which I haven't been to South by in quite some time. But I feel like Austin, speaking of like open bars and running around from show to show, it just became a complete blur after a while. And plus, your day gets started so early and ends so late. And then you're just kind of all week, you're like a zombie.
My feet, like once you get them out, in Austin, I feel like they're not going back into those shoes. Like, they're so, so like huge elephant feet at the end of the night.
Oh, I remember that feeling.
I was one of those that didn't know like what South by was all about, and I went, you know, my job sent me there, and like I was like, oh, I'll just wear heels.
Wow.
And then quickly found out that's not what you do there. It's like all commerce.
That is amazing.
Good lesson, though. Mona, correct me if I'm wrong. You grew up in Reno, Nevada, or no?
Correct.
Okay. Was there much of a scene there back in the day?
I mean, here's the thing. I didn't really get to leave the house a whole lot when I was little. Like, my parents were very conservative immigrant parents, so they were like, it's the devil's plaything out there. Like, you stay inside. So, probably. I don't know, though.
Yeah.
I remember when I was little, I want to say, like, Switchblade Symphony was the only band that came to Reno to play, which is crazy because they're, like, a not very big goth band. But... Yeah. Oh, Orgy played once, too.
Oh, okay. That's a throwback.
I'm the same. I mean, my parents never let me out ever, so I didn't have any freedom until I went to college.
Right?
So.
Did you go nuts in college? Because that's
totally.
What I did.
I think all of us are in that boat to some degree. Yeah. But what was frustrating for me is that when I was 14, 15, 16, 17 – I would be one of these people who would listen to alternative radio constantly. I'd call the number, win all the concert tickets, and then they'd come in the mail and I didn't get to go to any of them. Aww. And I'm like, but Mom, I need to see Mighty Mighty Boston's. She's like, you're not going to Irving Plaza, you know?
That's really funny. Yeah. I was like, I think I saw Cherry Pop and Daddies when I was in college.
That's amazing. I just snorted.
I know. Well, they're worth a snort.
That
sure.
was, yeah.
I remember when people swing danced.
Oh, that was a moment.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my God. Can I tie this weirdly back into Morrissey? Because when I saw Morrissey on Broadway, I met this woman who's very sweet, but she was telling me that her favorite band is Squirrel Nut Zippers. Like, how was that possible?
That's insane.
They were, and, like, maybe the least offensive.
I guess.
That's insane, though.
I know.
In
but
nice
didn't
way.
Andrew Bird come out of there? Or am I dreaming this? Possibly. He might have been a Squirrel Nut Zipper. I have to check.
Oh,
yeah.
I didn't know that.
I'm really
He's
Googling
all sorts of animals.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I feel like I was going to say something about that, and then I got distracted by the swing memories, and I, like, it was such a weird time.
It was so weird. And, you know, there was a moment when I was listening to all this alternative music, and, you know, my parents would be like, oh, my God, this Soundgarden thing is terrible, or whatever I was listening to. But then once swing became a thing, and, like, it became sort of, for a moment, like, top 40, my parents were like, oh, this is kind of cool. This is fun. It's like, I never need to listen to Brian Setzer, or whatever his name is, ever in my life.
Brian,
you know?
Oh, my God. Such a crazy tangent, sorry.
That was amazing. I just have like a flood of memories.
Oh my God. Jesus. And, well, you know, those were like my first concerts, like whatever the NYU program board put together, you know, for us freshmen.
That's,
you know?
Awesome, though. I mean, like... that's what I was going to say is that my mom didn't really let me leave the house, but then weirdly would let me go to shows in the Bay Area because my sister lived there. So she'd be like, oh, you can go visit her. And so I would see like Depeche or Susie or these crazy shows when I was like 12, 13. But
That's
like I
cool.
wasn't allowed to go to the mall. Like,
yeah.
But I'll take it.
Totally.
Why not? Yeah. Yeah. For me, it was also like college when I really kind of broke through and started seeing all these shows on my own. Because before that, like from the ages of, you know, early teens to 17, 18, it was a very limited group. Like I saw Alanis and Radiohead at Jones Beach, and my parents went with me and my brother, which is actually a sweet memory. But like, other than that, I saw Sting with my dad. It's that, not too much else. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome, though. I like that you went to shows with your family.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was your first show?
My first one was Alanis and Radiohead. Yeah. Jagged Little Pill tour, that album meant the world to me. And Radiohead was on the Benz tour. So, yeah.
That's a very kinda cool tour.
It was nutty. Yeah.
Yeah.
What was yours, Jen?
It was my first concert. I always like to say Stereolab, but that was like during college.
That's also very cool if that was your
first.
Yeah,
that is a very cool one.
I'm trying to think, like, what the first concert I ever, like, went to because I wanted to see them was Stereolab, Dots and Loops. It was weird because, like, I love that album, but they were very, like, boring to watch live.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of like, but I didn't really know, like, what going to shows is like, really, mm-hmm. you know. But, yeah, I mean, New York, going to school in New York is like crazy town.
I'm so jealous. I feel like it must have been amazing.
I was just like telling some cousins that like, because, you know, their kids are like going to college. And they're like, oh, you know, you're not going to have much to do because there's nothing around there. But, you know, you'll have time to study. And I was like, study? Like, who studies in college?
Like, it's a negative.
I was like, maybe like the first semester I did, because I was still like reeling from being like that like study girl in high mm-hmm. school. But like after like a couple months in the city, there's so many distractions, you know.
Of course. No, I was in University of Maryland College Park, which was kind of between DC and Baltimore, but essentially like it was the campus and then very little else, you know, huge campus and yeah, but I remember their booking in terms of like who would come on campus and perform. It was pretty atrocious now that I think about it. They had Fuel, they had Jimmy's Chicken Shack, they had Bloodhound Gang. It was awful. Howie Day. And I went to all of them because it was free and it was right there. You know.
I did see Liz Phair.
Oh, that's cool.
They programmed her.
That's awesome.
It was a little bit cooler than yours, Matt.
Yeah, we had really terrible booking. You know, they did have one thing at University of Maryland that was cool. They had George Clinton play once. That was okay. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, legend.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if we had anybody cool play Berkeley, but I don't remember. Like, not even one. But my first concert was New Kids on the Block.
Oh, okay, well, shit. That's legendary, though.
Like, Hanging Tough? Or
I don't even know. That must have been... What was the... like light purple one with like they're sitting on the steps.
Oh, I can't remember. Step by step, Hanging Tough. I
don't
remember.
Probably Step by Step if they're sitting on the steps. Let's see.
Yeah. Oh, I guess so. Yeah. Who was your favorite?
Obviously Jonathan. No. Jordan.
Yeah. Jordan was mine
like,
too.
Obviously.
No, I'm sorry. Jonathan's like the librarian. I'm sorry. I don't know.
He's like the one nobody. Well, Danny.
Nobody
was
Danny. Had
a, yeah, I'm not going to be mean, but Danny wasn't anyone's favorite.
No. Yeah. I was suspicious of the people that like Joey. Are you guys one of them?
I was a
Jin was a Joey fan.
I mean, he's so young looking.
You guys,
he aged very well.
I had his poster.
You like pan the camera and there it is.
Oh my god, that'd be so creepy if I saw it. Oh my god.
No, but you know what's so funny is that like I know I was a overweight queer kid and I had this gigantic New Kids on the Block button and I'm pretty sure it wasn't even the whole band, it was just Jordan. And it was like the size of a plate almost. And it was like, I would wear it every day on my jean jacket. And I think I was so cool.
Oh my God, Matt, we would have been best friends.
I know.
You're speaking my language.
Yeah, but I know my cousins got to see New Kids and I was super jealous. But at the time, like, I feel like there were just certain gender norms. Like, the boys don't see New Kids on the Block. Mm. That's what the girls go to with their mom and, you know, whatever. But, like, the boys didn't go to that. So it was one of those things.
It's funny because I went with my older sister, the one that, like, taught me about music and everything. And she's gay and she used to have very, very short hair in high school, and I was like really into Miss Piggy, so I would wear pink all the time, and people would always ask if we were boyfriend girlfriend, which would like really make me uncomfortable and her uncomfortable, and like, yeah. Or be like, are you guys brother sister, you boyfriend girlfriend or whatever. And it's like, I just remember, like, it's funny when you say like, oh, it wasn't, that's not what boys did, is go to New Kids, because I feel like now, thank God, I hope that little boys wouldn't think twice about doing something like that. And like, I feel like you would hope that like young girls don't have to like be made to feel ashamed for having short hair, or like that they're doing something wrong or something. But like, I was thinking that about that a lot lately, because I went to Reno and I was like, oh, there's just like so many bad memories of like people not minding their own business in small towns and just like making comments and stuff. So
I think on the whole, it's better now. If I were to kind of generalize, because I feel like, at least in terms of everything under the LGBTQ umbrella, I feel like young kids now, particularly kids under 25, maybe under 21, they're a lot more, I feel like the shackles are kind of gone. You know, I think growing up as a queer kid and a teenager in the 90s and stuff, it was like kind of, I don't know, you couldn't have been as open now. But now you see like, you know, 15-year-old queer kids that are just embracing it and posting photos of themselves, and they're very proud, and I think that's great, you know? I think there's been some progress, is what I'm trying to say, over the last 20 years as it relates to queer kids.
Teens. I mean, if I ever wanted kids, I would want them to be LGBTQ.
Oh my God, please. Yeah, like I would, like, that's, if I, same thing, if I ever wanted kids, I would pray.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's also, again, a generalization, because I'm not hanging out with 14-year-olds, so I'm not sure. But I feel like from friends that have kids, that queer culture or even gender fluidity is such a sign of alternative culture. Whereas, like, we used to, like, dye our hair pink. Now, using different pronouns is, like, a sign of asserting your uniqueness or your otherness or something, which I love. Because I feel like that was far too radical for when I was growing up.
Yeah. I think there's too many limitations that people were putting on themselves before, and now they're more open. And, you know, as far as I can see, I mean, you know, I think there's still conservative people out there, but overall, I think we're a little bit more open, and I hope it continues.
Yeah. Should we hop into Repeat Skip?
Yes.
Okay. So the first album we're going to talk about today is Morrissey's 1997 album, Maladjusted. I have a lot of thoughts on, but I just say that I feel like in terms of critical acclaim, it was like, it was kind of lukewarm. I feel like some reviewers are into it, but I think it got ignored to some degree. And then once he disappeared for a few years after this and put out You're the Quarry, that was kind of considered like the big comeback album. And I feel like Maladjusted kind of sometimes gets forgotten about. But I mean, I still think there are some really strong moments on this album. It's not my favorite Morrissey record. So what do y'all think?
For me, Maladjusted, it has a special place in my heart because that was the first tour that I ever saw him live. And I remember when he played the Warfield. My sister and I drove from Reno to San Francisco and listened to Maladjusted the whole way through, like a million times going there. And I remember when he came on stage, I screamed so hard, my sides hurt. Like, I was like, you know when you see the Beatles girls and you're like, how is that real? I feel like that was actually me. I was so excited. But you're right, like the album is certainly not his strongest out of his solo or Smith's career, but there's definitely some excellent songs on it.
Jan, do you have memories of this record?
No, I don't really have a lot of Morrissey memories, to be honest. Like, I feel like I saw him on MTV. That was the first time I ever seen, like, had heard of him, because I didn't like listen to a lot of Britpop back then. Yeah, I don't know. And then I was like, who is this guy that everyone's like freaking out over? Like, everybody was like, he's the Beatles or something, you know? It was totally like that. You know, I just didn't like really like live with this album. But listening to it to, you know, for this episode, I realized I knew more songs than I thought I would, mm-hmm. you know, and yeah. And my likes were probably the hits or whatever on the album.
Well, I think the singles from this release are really strong, actually, particularly Alma Matters. I feel like I've seen Morrissey so many times, and almost every single time, at least in the last 15 years, he does that song, and I never really tire of it. And I don't know why. That's one of those songs that like hits me in a way that I can't really fully describe, but it still makes me emotional. So I'll never tire of that song, and I'll probably never tire of the title track. And then I feel like as the album progresses, he loses me a little bit in certain spots. Mona.
Yeah. Same songs, but also I'm going to throw in Trouble Loves Me because mm-hmm. I feel like that is such a like emotional song for me for some mm-hmm. reason. Mm-hmm. But same thing towards the end of the album is Stinky Town. Sorrow will come to you in the end. I remember the first time I heard it where it's like, lawyer, liar. I'm like, okay. All right, gay.
It's really a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
For me, I just feel like when you know, on Vauxhall and I, when he put out, obviously it was a huge single for him, The More You Ignore Me, which I feel like kind of deals with the same topic of him just being pissed about the Smiths royalties and whatnot. So I would have thought that he would like put it behind him and not put out another track that was kind of this dig, but he holds a grudge.
Yeah. That'll be on his epitaph. Yeah, exactly. He holds a grudge.
I just love it because, like, the lyrics, don't close your eyes, don't ever close your eyes. A man who slits throats has time on his hands, and I'm going to get you. And then when Mike Joyce was asked about, like, what he thought of that, because that was, like, basically directed towards him, he just said, I found it funny. If Lemmy had written it, I might be concerned. Like, and it was just like, yeah, you're not scared of Morrissey.
No.
Like, that guy's not hurting anybody.
No.
You know, in the end, you know, Mike Joyce won and got his fair share of royalties. I don't know why people get so bitter about stuff like that. It happens to a lot of bands.
I feel like, I don't know, can we talk about this on the show? Like, what Morrissey's become and what that has done to our fandom? Or is that, like, too broad a topic for this, for today?
I think we could touch upon it quickly. I mean, I never really discussed personally, like, kind of how I disassociated myself, but it's not a very long story. It's just kind of like, listen, we all know he's been problematic for a while, but I feel like I've personally have kind of made excuses for it or brushed it aside. And then, you know, the last time I saw him, I went to 4 shows out of the 7 on the Broadway run in May of 2019. And then during that week, he performed on Fallon with the For Britain, you know, alt-right pin. And I mean, he's just said so many terrible things the last couple of years as it relates to a million different topics, but particularly like anti-immigrant. And I don't know, at a certain point, it's just like, it becomes like exhausting to defend him, and he's not worth defending. And it's like, I don't know, it can be kind of like toxic or something. And for me, and the last thing I'll say is that like, he has meant so much to me and changed my life for, you know, 20 something years that I'm okay actually like kind of not listening to anything new starting a few months ago. Like, I have no interest in like ever giving him any more of my money personally. But those songs, you know, Smith songs and Morrissey solo songs through the last album will forever mean so much to me and really help me navigate a whole range of circumstances. So that's my 2 cents.
Oh, so eloquent. I feel like really sums up a lot of how fans are feeling. Like, I feel like I did listen to the new album that he put out this year, and it's actually great, but mm-hmm. I listened to it once and just never felt inspired to go back to it because of the same thing. Like, I've lost my faith in the human. And I think that that was, And you're right. Like, I think I did make excuses for so long because the rest of what he did meant so much to me. Like, I feel like he was a voice for that. Not, I don't know of any other artists that were like touting asexuality or like, just, I don't know, that kind of androgyny or nerdy culture. Like, I don't know, just so many things that I feel like he made it okay to talk about depression and kind of heavy topics that I'll never forget. And I'll always hold so dear to my heart, those albums and even the iconography of old Morrissey. But yeah, I don't really have a lot of time for him anymore, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, it makes me sad too, actually.
Most of the time, if I find out something about like a celebrity or an artist, it ruins them for me. But I do think I agree with you guys where like listening to this album, all the songs that really like I recognize, I was like, it felt good. It still felt good to like listen to it. Whereas like, say like Michael Jackson, I can't listen to Michael Jackson anymore.
No, no. After watching that documentary, like, yeah, I can't. I can't ever really listen to him.
It's like different, you know, and maybe it's just because, you know, what he's saying in you know, the politics right now is not really that related to, you know, like his lyrics and songs and whatnot from the past that we all like hold so dear. But, you know, whereas like when I listen to Michael Jackson, I'm like, ugh, that lyric is so gross now. I just can't.
For me, it's kind of a mind fuck with Morrissey because I feel like so much of what he represented with the Smiths and for most of his solo career was kind of standing up for people and like embracing kind of your individuality. And now it's just kind of, I feel like he's abandoned so much of what he stood for. And that's like, when I think of early Smith singles, I think of like him standing up for the working class and whatnot. And now it's like, he's aligning himself with this crap. I don't know. It throws me.
I almost wonder if it's like trolling or something, but regardless, I feel like that there's less tolerance today for that. I feel like I think about that a lot with other artistic movements or artists that kind of prided themselves on trolling, like the kind of, I want to say like a Boyd Rice or something like that, where you're like, if your whole thing is challenging the way people think, I don't want to be challenged today. I just want to know you're on my side and you're not going to be standing for terrible things. Like there's too much going on right now for me to enjoy this artistic challenge.
Yeah.
It feels too serious.
Totally.
Agreed. One other song I just want to mention that I love from this album that is towards the end, or I believe it's the last track, is Satan Rejected My Soul. I feel like if I'm ever at a bar and they have this album, this is the one I want to play for some reason. but yeah, otherwise I would probably pick Alma Matters and Maladjusted and then probably skip He Cried.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm with Mona. I really like Alma Matters and Trouble Loves Me as well. And for all the same reasons. And I would definitely skip Sorrow.
Sorrow needs to be skipped also. Yeah.
Also, I didn't really like Roy's Keen. I don't know.
Yeah, I'll give you that one too.
You know what I find interesting is that this album came out, like in his autobiography, he admitted that he had this relationship with a photographer named Jake Walters in the mid-90s. And I assume that this album was recorded as it was ending. So maybe that also, I don't know, there's like sort of a bitter tone in some of the songs. It could be because of the breakup. I don't know exactly. But it's interesting, the timing, because I feel like, well, Southpaw Grammar is its own thing. But like, I feel like Vauxhall and I is a little... like there's some love on that record and I feel like there's not a lot of love on this release. It's a little darker.
Very dark. But also, can we talk about how you got through the autobiography?
Like, oh my God.
I would consider myself a huge fan and I got through page 50 where he's still 8 years old. Like,
it was a journey and I actually couldn't wait till it got to the US, so I ordered it from the UK and like paid for a ridiculous amount of shipping and I got it like, you know, as early as I could humanly get it. You know that there are no chapter, well, you know, there are no chapter breakdowns and there's no like paragraph spacing. Everything is just like one thing.
It's a nightmare.
It's really a nightmare. And Listen, it's like, I don't even know, like 400 or 500 pages. But for me, what was wild and kind of tying back to this album and Sorrow Will Come in the End, I'm not kidding. I think the mid-90s situation with the lawsuit and the Smiths and the royalties was literally like 85 pages. And I'm like, can we please move on? Nobody needs to read 85 pages of that, you know?
Yeah, nobody cares about copyright and percentages.
It was not sexy at all.
I think 20 pages was just listing everything he heard on the radio from age 5 to 7, which I like made a playlist of. And then I was like exhausting myself reading this thing. And I was like, I can't. I give up. She's done.
Yeah, I'll never read it again. Shall we pop into the second album, which is a lot more light?
Yeah. Totally different.
Okay, it's Erasure's Chorus, which was put out in 1991. This is a fun album.
Ugh, I'm obsessed.
Yeah.
It was super fun. I actually loved like almost all of it. It was hard to pick a skip, actually, for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I picked the obvious one, Love to Hate You.
Yeah, I think it seems like we all kind of are on the same page. That's just such an incredible single.
That video too. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but where he's like cha cha pata parade down the like catwalk and stomping with the water, and like, oh
yeah,
I love it.
Oh my god, I was like, oh, this song is so like, I know this part, it's so well known, and then I was like, oh, it's I Will Survive. Like, it's being sampled in the song. I forgot about that.
I never caught that, actually.
I was just like, I was like talking to Ryan like, oh, everybody knows this part of the song. And then I like, when I was like reading about it, I was like, I Will Survive? Oh, duh.
You just blew my mind. How did they afford that? No disrespect to them. I mean, I'm sure they're very rich.
Yeah, it's a good question.
I think they were on the same label, maybe.
I think they've been on, they've been on mute for most of, I think their entire catalog, but Mute actually was bought by BMG for a while, so I think there was probably a lot more money in the 90s, and then Daniel rebought Mute as an independent label, I want to say in like 2000 or so. So like, we don't have all that catalog still on Mute, but it still says Mute Records, which is the BMG company, but our Mute is doesn't say records afterwards.
Okay, you know, I've always noticed that, but didn't know the reasoning. Okay.
Sorry, that was really boring minutia.
No, no, that's good to know. This is like trivia hour right now. I just want to say that, like, I remember this gay 80s dance party I used to go to in the aughts, maybe like in 03, 04. It was at Pyramid Club. And it was called 1984, and pretty much they didn't even have a live DJ. They would just play the same 20 songs on a loop every single week. And one of them was Love to Hate You. And then Ola Moore was on there also. So I don't know. I just have memories of like getting my groove on and going home with someone and like just kind of, I don't know. It's happy, drunken early 20s memories.
Totally. Yeah. The B side of Love to Hate You is a track called La La La. That is like one of the greatest. I even pulled out the like CD single because I was so excited about it. But I was like, memories. I love that. I think they just reissued it in the UK, but I don't see it digitally in the US. But if you can find La 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 and Vitamin C or the B-sides to the Love to Hate You single, chef's kiss.
Okay.
I love that you have that, of course. Yeah, no, I mean, this was like their disco album, kind of. I'll be nerdy and like look shit up about the album, and I realized like the album covers were like their partly their MRI scans or something, which I think is really weird.
I had no idea about that.
Me neither. That's so awesome.
It's like funny because in the liner notes, like they like thank the hospital. MRIs, I guess. But yeah, like it's actually, I don't remember, maybe it was like the US or UK version where like the heads are sideways. In the US version, maybe where they're sideways, and then in UK or somewhere else, it's like straightforward. Like, you know, they're looking straightforward, which is kind of weird.
That's interesting. I wonder why they did the alternate covers.
I'm not really sure.
Tomorrow at work. Beep boop. Hello.
Actually, I wanted to know if you've ever met them.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have. They're really kind, like amazing human beings. They actually have an album, did I mention, coming out?
Yes. The Neon.
The Neon. We don't have to talk about it right now, but they are just the coolest people you'll ever meet. Like, there's zero pretension to them. So it's not only an honor to work with them because their music is amazing, but like, unlike some of the examples I think we've been talking about, they are just really nice, down to earth people as well.
And you can kind of feel like that they would be cool.
They're still really humble, which I like. I, especially for, I think, two artists of such a success, like of that level of success. Like the fact that Andy still, I think, sometimes voices his insecurities about not sounding like Alison Moyet and like how deep and soulful her voice is, which is was amazing too. But Andy's voice is amazing itself, and like he's been doing this for 40 years and has sold millions of records and all these chart numbers, and he's still you know, a little shy about things. I find that really endearing and charming.
Oh, I love his voice. Being like, I feel, you know, he definitely has a, his own kind of soul to his voice, and it just has this like really delicate emotion that I just really love. Gets me like all the time. Was it hard for you guys to pick a skip? Because it was hard for me.
Really
for me,
hard.
For me it was actually kind of like one that was obvious that wasn't my bag, but everything else was pretty incredible. And for me, that song was Joan. I just felt like it was very, like, M.O.R. and, like, kind of unnecessary. I don't even actually think that it was, you know, could they could have cut the album by one track, in my view.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah.
How dare you?
I feel like you just, like, called my mom ugly.
I don't know why that one just didn't move me re-listening to this album for the first time in 30 years.
That's really funny. Well, we all kind of agreed, I guess, in the end, you know. Like, I picked, like, Siren Song and maybe Home. They both kind of have, like, these weird choir backup vocals that I thought, you know, I don't know. But they were still kind of cool. I don't know. So it was hard.
It is hard. I would say I would agree with both of your choices. And I swear to God, it's not just because I like want to agree because you're both adorable. But I genuinely agreed with all your picks for the repeat skips. And I feel like you don't have to like pick the, I don't know, B-side to be as your repeat because it was good. Like sometimes it's just the best song is the single. So
yeah, I think sometimes I'll speak for myself, like I feel very kind of basic or boring to pick the obvious single, but in a lot of cases, especially on a really strong kind of pop release, you know, that is one of the stronger tracks, you know?
Yeah. I think if you also like had a lot of memories like about it, it gives you a certain kind of feeling, and that's how I usually pick it. It's like, how does this song make me feel, you know? And it's usually the more nostalgic ones are like the ones you listen to a lot back in the day because they were like the hit, you know.
To take it back to the Alzheimer's comp, the there's a big thing about how music in studies that the part of your brain that processes music isn't relatively unaffected by the disease, so that there'll be people that are at times even like almost nonverbal, but they'll respond to music, or they'll there's a HBO documentary about Alzheimer's, and there's a patient in there that has like, again, nonverbal, but he's in a choir, and when he sings, like he automatically, when he's with his group, he just automatically was like hitting every note and knew every word, but then when it was done was back to, so it's interesting the nostalgia in these songs, and I wonder how these songs will impact me when I'm older. Like, am I gonna you know, maybe I'll be nonverbal somewhere and Love to Hate You will come on and I'll get out and I'll pot a beret out of my wheelchair.
Exactly.
And maybe I won't. I don't know. I hope, though. I hope that I keep these songs with me forever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think that will happen.
I think so, too. And I think, you know, it's just deep, deeply connected to our emotions. So I think, you know, music is magic in that way.
Mm-hmm. That's probably a good note to go out on, no?
Yeah.
Music is magic.
I mean, I think you've said it all, really.
Thank you so much for joining us. This was so fun to catch up.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was so much fun talking. We'll catch you next time on
Mixtape Memories. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.